You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS, and welcome to UCL. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. Each year here in STS, we select one book that we ask everyone in our community to read. It's the STS One Book Program, and it's something we use to create some common ground, a bit of glue to hold everyone together across our huge range of academic interests. This year, the book is by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ian Urbina. It's titled The Outlaw Ocean, published in 2019. The book is part of Urbina's Outlaw Ocean project, also a website, a podcast, some documentaries, and a whole network of people investigating human activities on, around, and in that giant space we normally think of as just kinda out there. This is exceptional investigative journalism. It's stark, it's uncomfortable, it's revealing, it's also rich in themes connected with STS. To launch our work with Outlaw Ocean, I sat down with Dr. Michelle Wahome. She's a lecturer in science and technology studies here in the department. She's an expert in digital entrepreneurs, and she's an expert using STS to study international governance around oceans. Michelle recommended the book, and she's using it in one of our key modules for the first year students, the class that works to directly relate what we academics do to big problems in the world around us. I loved our conversation, and it really opened my eyes. And I hope it starts to open up your eyes, too. To get us started, I asked Michelle to introduce herself and to introduce the new STS One Book.
My name is Michelle Wahome. I am a lecturer in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at UCL.
Brilliant. Thanks. And thanks for coming today. This is really nice to talk to you.
I am happy to be here.
So we're here to talk about the STS One Book for next year. Mm-hmm. So you want to tell us what it is?
It is The Outlaw Ocean, Crime and Survival in the Last Untamed Frontier by Ian Urbina.
Great. Just a couple of questions to get us oriented about the book itself, and then we'll talk about the content and why you chose it and what is STS about it.
Yeah.
So this is a huge book. Can you just quickly summarize what it's about?
The book is about how the ocean, the global ocean, is kind of the wild, wild west. It's the last frontier that man has not fully tamed. And it talks about how there's a lack of legal jurisdiction in this space and what that leads to and how our relationship to the ocean unfolds in that sort of lawless jurisdiction. But for me, it's not primarily a legal story. I'm particularly interested in the narrative it tells about how technology shapes our relationship to the ocean, as well as thinking about our place within this interconnected web of nature, how we see ourselves.
Brilliant. So the immediate draw is that notion of an outlaw, like the Wild West.
Yeah.
But you see it as a much more deep and nuanced book.
Yes.
Great. And we're going to get into that in just a couple of minutes. So that's the book. What do you know about the author? Who's the author?
I know very little other than what he says about himself online. And in the book, name is Ian Urbina. He sounds to be quite the adventurous sort. I did like reading about the fact that he has a background in history and anthropology, which I think will be of interest to our students as well, and how he's managed to segue that background into investigative journalism and generate a series of stories that then led him to receive all these accolades like the Pulitzer and that sort of thing.
What I took away from that is he's a historian and anthropologist.
Yes.
And so back to that careers kind of question about what do you do with an STS degree?
Mm-hmm.
Well, boy, you become a journalist and you write about this kind of stuff. So you snuck in that career story very, very nicely. So we recommended this for the STS One Book.
Yes.
Which, if listeners don't know, it's one book we pick every year and we ask everybody in our STS community to read it. And the idea is it becomes a kind of common ground across a huge range of courses And it's just one book that we can talk about. So you're the instigator here. Tell us why you chose this for the STS One book.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. I'll start with the more teaching-oriented reasons. So STS traditionally has taken these sort of scientific realms and framed them through a social lens. And this book gives us the opportunity to do that, to see the ocean, which we tend to regard as a sort of biological realm, a natural place. And the book allows us to see how humans interact with it and the sociality of it and what happens with that. And we also see how technology shapes that relationship, how things evolve over time as our technology improves. How does our relationship to this natural place change? There's this underlying theme about how the exploitation of nature also often involves the exploitation of people. And that's a story that we don't often see in such stark reality as told in this book. Part of the reason I selected this book is because the theme for this year's big problems is the state of the ocean. We're in the middle of the UN decade of the ocean. And the theme of the decade is the science we need for the ocean we want. And that's a very STS-oriented theme. And I hoped to find a book that would match that kind of theme. So those are the sort of pedagogical reasons for selecting the book. Another reason for selecting it is this idea I have that as a person enters university, some of the experiences are expected to be eye-opening. They're also entering adulthood. And this book is a kind of book that initiates you into seeing the world in a very different way and seeing somewhat different perspectives.
I often think about the oceans as being filled with water and animals.
Yeah.
But it's also filled with people. And Urbina talks about this. And he gives a number which shocked me. He said 56 million people around the world work in fishing fleets.
Mm-hmm.
56 million people? Are you kidding? I mean, that makes me feel like the ocean is full of people all over. That's a really exciting notion. Also, our encounter with the ocean mm-hmm. is at the beach.
Mostly.
Right?
Yeah.
Most people, most of the time, that's our encounter. But our encounter with the deep ocean or the big ocean is really minimal now, isn't it?
It is very minimal. It's mostly in media. You know, we might watch movies about it and hear about it. So there's this realm that we are completely detached from. And as you say, there are 56 million people involved in it in some fashion. And so I thought this was a good opportunity to open up. And that's also related to something our students always tell us about being an STS scholar, is that it opens their eyes and sort of shows them a different way of looking at the world. So I thought all these ideas came together nicely through this book.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Well, let's dive into the book. Oh, there, I snuck in an ocean metaphor. Okay, cancel that. So anytime, folks, I sneak in a diving narrative, just ignore it. It's entirely unintentional. But let's get into the book. And the book has lots of chapters mm-hmm. because, as you said, there's lots of stories. And you could almost just read one or two chapters and leave the book behind.
Exactly.
I asked you to think about what would be one of the chapters that you thought was most striking. So what did you pick?
So I thought I'd focus on Storming the Thunder, which is the first chapter. I debated between that one and the second because the second one also allows you to see how international the issues are and how different places around the world are affected by mm-hmm. overfishing and that sort of thing. But we'll stick to Storming the Thunder mm-hmm. and talk about it. Did you enjoy reading?
I did. There are a couple of chapters that really grabbed my attention, but let's talk about Storming the Thunder first. So what is the thunder? What is storming? And what's this chapter about?
Well, the thunder is a trawler, a large trawler. It's on Interpol's list of, which I didn't know existed, of wanted fishing vessels mm-hmm. because it engages in a lot of illegal fishing. We are introduced to a crew of environmental activists who have taken to the seas as well to chase the thunder and try and get it, bring it to justice, right? And so I was very interested in this intrepid crew who had sort of dedicated their lives to being vigilante police of the oceans and what it took. There's no school for vigilante chasing fishing vessels. And so I was really interested in the interactions between the illegal ship and the other illegal ship, really. And also within that chapter, that the story about how technical capabilities have changed on board of these ships and what enhances their capabilities for over-exploiting the ocean. There's an analogy that's drawn about how fishing goes from being a version of hunting to essentially a style of farming, and really over-farming in many cases. And so I really enjoyed the chapter, and it's very adventurous. And thrilling. You can almost watch it in your mind's eye as a movie.
It's really a chase, isn't it?
Yes.
And go back to the outlaw nature. You sort of think of the Wild West, and you think of somebody is alleged to have done something wrong. There's a posse organized, and the posse chases the baddies. And in a way, that chapter is framed around the chase. And again, you think about the Wild West and you think, well, who's organized the posse and who said that was a good idea and who said that was lawful?
Exactly.
And you framed it yourself about the two different ships, maybe. Who knows who's on the right side and where's justice sit here?
Absolutely.
And again, very, very interesting STS kind of concepts there, knocking around in the very first chapter. Plus it's a chase, so you get to follow the chase. Well, the chase ends specifically. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, the chase ends with a kind of surrender by the Thunder. Not to give too much away as you're reading it, but the way in which the vigilante chasers, I think they were on the Bob Barker, which was interesting to learn about how they name their ships. So the Bob Barker captures the crew of the Thunder. And the way they treat the crew is very interesting to understand the kind of complexity that's involved here in understanding how the people who are on the Thunder come to be there and what the pressures and reasons for their being there, how they're related to their own livelihood interests and the inequalities that exist around the world. So I found that to be an important thing to highlight as well, as you say, when thinking about who the good guys versus the bad guys are. That story isn't so clear cut. And eventually some people brought to justice, but I will let you find out what happened.
Urbina separates sort of the boss of the crew, the people who take care of the ship, and then people who do the thing that the ship is out there to do in the first place. So the fishing crew, as it were.
Yeah.
And if you think of them as labor, then you can ask questions about, well, where'd they come from? How did they sign up? What are their working conditions? What's the pay? What are their rights? And all those questions back to the outlaw. If you're in the Wild West, who makes the laws? He regularly comes back to that question of, is this a lawless state or are there other things going on here? Mm-hmm. At every turn, he raises those really questions. Did another chapter stand out for you that you want to talk about?
Well, I feel the chapter that follows is quite related to the first one. We are introduced more to the question of the laborers or the actors who are involved as crew on these ships. And we also are introduced to a small island nation and its interests and its commitments to taking care of its area within its national jurisdiction, its ocean space, and why it's interested and how it feels about its position within the world. And yeah, there's a comment there by the president of Palau that he's just glad that someone's listening or so that someone cares. And it's interesting to think of these countries as having to do sort of do this on their own in the face of larger superpowers who have more money and are more resourced and also technologically resourced as well. So I think the second chapter is a good follow on from hearing about the Thunder as an enterprise, but also there's a lot of issues about national jurisdiction and who polices whom. And then the second chapter then brings us into this story about a country, a small country that's very committed to this policing. But can they do it? What resources do they have available to them? And some of the tragedies that outcomes of the fact that they're not well resourced. There's a story in there about a debacle, really. And it's related to the fact that they're not technologically.
And you can think of a country, say, with 5 policing ships. Mm-hmm. And if you've got international fishing fleets arriving in the numbers of 50 or 100, well, 5 against 50, you don't have to be too sophisticated to know that's not going to end well. And so who comes to the rescue? Well, there isn't a rescue, I think, is ultimately what Urbina wants to talk about. And then what are the consequences of that for us?
Yeah.
So we've got an outlaw ocean. I was going to sneak in my favorite story, which is the story of Sealand, which is a story that some English communities may know very well, that it's essentially a platform in the English Channel. And it was a platform created in World War II. And it was used by the Royal Navy, then abandoned after the war. And somebody, through a means I didn't quite understand, they come to own that platform and they occupy it and claim it's their own country. And so they spend a lot of time declaring that and enforcing that and then figuring out what kind of economy can I have here. Mm-hmm. It lives in a part of the channel that is far enough away from England that the United Kingdom doesn't really have jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And so by all the rules that everybody agreed to run by, there's this platform.
Right.
And this family creates what they call their own country. And there is that myth of living in a lawless state. And people don't call it lawless. They call it free. That balance between lawless and freedom. Some people, mostly men, it seems, just seem to hanker for this ideal world where there's no rules and nobody tells me what to do.
Right.
And they want that until somebody bigger comes along and starts pushing them around. Then they desperately want somebody bigger to tell them what to do. In Outlaw Ocean, Urbina goes to visit and he tells stories about what they're up to and what are they trying to do. And nothing particularly sinister, but something that comes out is really interesting, that they themselves develop a kind of morality. Mm-hmm. So once they're in this outlaw space, a lot of baddies arrive and they want to exploit the platform owners. They start saying, well, we don't want to do that. We're willing to do this, but not that. So casinos, fine. Kiddie porn, no.
Right.
And they start drawing their own boundaries. And that, again, is a fascinating narrative of how people are evolving through the reality of being in this kind of a space. And then Urbina takes that story and moves it forward in a couple of different ways. He starts talking about a situation with a abortion clinic in Mexico that decides that the way they're going to get around the national restrictions on women's health, that they're going to essentially charter a ship and go outside of the national waters and perform the abortions and then come back in again. So they use the lawless state as a place of freedom, as a place where they want to do something that they feel like the nationality is prohibiting. And that's a really nice juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Because whatever your politics are, you probably see one of those behaviors as good and one of those behaviors as bad.
Yes, that is a great juxtaposition. I enjoyed that chapter as well. I researched digital entrepreneurs, so I was very interested to see their insertion into this tale, particularly the billionaire types. So on the one hand, you have Sealand that has been created by someone who's not particularly wealthy. It's supposed to be a romantic gesture, but I find that it's funny that he ends up being on the platform for months away from his wife. But yes, he claims it on her behalf and she's on the money and everything. So he's just an individual who is interested in this idea of freedom. I also was very interested in the fact that his background was military. So he has had this process of being institutionalized within a government-oriented institution. But then he has these ideas about what freedom looks like and its relationship to governance. Then you have these billionaires who also have a particular view of the role of government in circumscribing their activities. And so they have a particular interest in offshoring and not being under anyone's jurisdiction. Yeah, it is a very interesting story about freedom and what it allows and doesn't allow. And yes, definitely allows us to think about the rule of law and what value it has, the social contracts that we create amongst us and what values we're expressing by doing that.
I think that's a better area to think about than can this place exist as a country? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you create a new country on planet Earth? I think that's a rabbit hole that gets us into things that aren't really STS. But I think this idea of the libertarian vision and the promotion of certain kinds of activities mm-hmm. and how does science and technology facilitate that?
Yeah.
Because the Sealand would be nothing if there were no internet.
Yes.
Right. It would be nothing if there were no undersea cables. There would be, it'd just be some folks who are out there with a wind turbine and thanks very much. We'll send you some food every week. You
know,
that's about it. But not once you add the technology of communication, you get into an unregulated space and then all kinds of other things happen. And mm-hmm. that again, it's, you know, we always talk about the dark web, but the dark web lives somewhere.
Yep.
And if it lives on a server on this island, then something's going on. But anyway, so we've got Sealand as one kind of story. We've got medical treatments that are prohibited on land, taken off sea for things. Mm-hmm. And we've got a nice juxtaposition there. The thing that it really made me think about these days is there's a lot of political interest at the moment in these free port concepts. Mm-hmm. Particularly in the United Kingdom, it hasn't been talked about much, but the last conservative government established lots of these things called free ports, and they're places where the rules that apply in the rest of the UK don't apply. Mm-hmm. And that notion of free, it's not sold as lawlessness. It's sold as freedom.
Right.
And so free isn't, it doesn't cost you. It's free as in free from regulation. Mm-hmm. And the regulations that we put in to protect ourselves are removed. And so again, I think it's another example of, let's call it an outlaw space, an outlaw land in this country right now going on. And it'd be fascinating to see in the next couple of years what happens as a consequence, both as the national environment changes, mm-hmm. but also lots of narratives come out about what's happened in those so-called free spaces.
It's so telling that it's always in relation to business and making money mm-hmm. that this idea of freedom begins to get traction. Free market, we tend to think of it as a good thing for the invisible hand to, mm-hmm. you know, take charge of things. But now that we add this connotation of outlaw, we have to think a little harder about what it is we mean by the word free and who is allowed to participate and what does participation mean? Because, you know, we've talked about the laborers on these ships and the kind of experience they might be having in a zone of the world that is quote unquote free.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see that they're, you know, wealthy actors who have a particular interest because it will have monetary benefit for them to be able to act freely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just can't think of outlaw without thinking of baddie.
Yeah.
And again, this book makes you think hard about whether that's true.
Yeah.
And so many of the examples are baddie stories.
Right.
But there are also embedded in the book are goodie stories mm-hmm. and, or at least things that I walk away thinking, well, it's not terrible. It's not so bad. It's
yeah.
not, no, actually that's pretty good. They're really making use of this in a positive way. Although that is the minority of stories in the book, but I think it nicely says that there is a fluid boundary here. It's not just all dystopia.
Yes. Yes. And I was worried at some point that it was too dystopic, but I decided that it's good to start out your university career with a bit of a jarring.
And of course, we certainly are interested in what can you do about it? What do you do about
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely.
And the more we think about it, the better, because then we feel like we can act in one way or another.
Yeah.
Let me jump in here just so we can take a short break.
I'm Heiss, an IBSE student studying policy, communications, and ethics. What I love about STS is the diversity. You get to meet people from various backgrounds and discuss the current issues and topics, which are fascinating and engaging.
Let's get back to my interview with Dr. Michelle Wahome about the STS One book, Ian Urbina's 2019 work, The Outlaw Ocean. What other kind of themes mm-hmm. come to your mind in terms of the book?
Right. What I would like to emphasize is the presence or absence of the ocean within the stories that are told, right? So within STS, we have a theory called actor network theory that I tend to avoid. However, reading this book did make me think of actor network theory. If we were thinking of the ocean itself as an actor within these narratives, has Urbina done a good job of thinking through or with the ocean? He mentions at the very beginning how our relationship to the ocean as a larder that's inexhaustible, and thinking of the creatures that live within it as seafood, how that sort of influences our relationship to it. However, I wonder if he has gone full length or the capacity of thinking about how the ocean might feature within these stories, how it enables certain activities or challenges them or makes them more difficult. And so as a reader, as I go through the chapters, I'm always thinking, I'm thinking about them. I'm like, oh my goodness, am I now developing an affinity for network theory? And so I wanted to highlight that, because that will be a theory that students are introduced to, and this might be a good way of thinking about that.
That's a really great way to answer the question, how does this connect to STS? That's fantastic. So maybe actor network theory is useful here. Yes. And folks, if you don't know what actor network theory is, just look it up. We're not going to explain it today. But the general connection here is maybe some of the tools that sociology uses to think about other areas, maybe it's not just applicable to talking about oceans and what human beings are doing in and around the oceans, mm-hmm. but maybe it's enlightening. Maybe it tells us more than we previously.
Right.
Or we say it a slightly different way. Maybe it's mind bending.
Yes, absolutely. The network theory was one of the things that I initially to STS. It was one of the things that drew me to STS because it was so out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very interesting to learn about, but very difficult to apply in my own research and studies. So I have been pleased that this book has allowed me to think with it again, as I did many moons ago. And also one thing that came strongly was the fact that it's such a connector. And not just geographically, that we all, you know, connected via the ocean as a trading route and that sort of thing, but the people who have lived on it and interacted with it in a real way seem to have a brotherhood, sisterhood, fraternity, whatever. And they're all of an international lot. So it's kind of a melting pot, this ocean. And you find people from all over, from different parts of the world working together as crew in the worst conditions and in circumstances that are very challenging and rough. But they seem to develop their own ways of relating to each other and understanding one another. And you get this sense that whenever Urbina enters a new ship or ocean space, he has to sort of be initiated into it, right? And even though the actors within it are very varied, they have a commonality. And in order for you to operate there, you have to sort of be welcomed into this new nation of people.
Yeah, it's not that there's a secret handshake, but there's I think of the example that I always tell in history of biology is Darwin on the voyage of the Beagle. He's seasick, and he's seasick for months and months at the beginning of the voyage, and never really quite develops his sea legs. Well, the sailors who are on the ship, they make fun of him all the time, because here's this rich kid who doesn't really know much about anything. He doesn't really know how to tie a knot. He can't climb the mast. He can't do very much. And he's also seasick. And so this guy's credibility is rock bottom in terms of the sailors. But Darwin fancies himself a bit of a lad, and so he wants to associate with them. And eventually one of the stories that he tells, and then he starts to tell it over and over and over, it's a story called Crossing the Line, which is if you haven't crossed the equator before, then there's an initiation rite. And so basically they dunk water on you and make fun of you. And the basic idea is, when Darwin was initiated into the brotherhood of the ship, he uses the story Crossing the Line. So when they initiated me, they took me in. And he loved to tell that story, because it's exactly as you said. It made him feel like he suddenly belonged and he was no longer an outsider. Mm-hmm. It's a great example of like a really boring history story you layer on top a bit of STS, a bit of sociology, and you look at that event and you say, well, okay, not only do we understand what's happening, it's an initiation like every other initiation story we've heard, but also hearing it over and over and over again, you think, okay, now we learned something about Darwin, about how he, what he prioritized in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And plenty of people don't care about Darwin, and I'm sorry about that. But at the same time, that it's a nice use of that. Urbina has lots of stories about that. Mm-hmm. He writes in there very interestingly that he doesn't get seasick for some physiological reason. He says, I don't get seasick. And when I read that, I thought, no wonder everybody takes you in, because you've got your sea legs. You kind of know what's going on. Because, I mean, certainly there are a lot of sticky moments in the book that he recounts. Mm-hmm. And no doubt there are more sticky moments that he doesn't recount. But I then thought, well, why didn't somebody just throw you off the ship? I mean, not literally like leave my ship, but take you and throw you off the ship so that you're in the ocean now. And nobody does. And I find that there's a not just resilience, but he has a life skill there to stop people from doing.
Right. Maybe he has some charisma, or as the kids say, riz.
Riz. Yeah. Okay. He's got the riz. I'm going to misuse that language.
Yeah. Let's avoid using the slang.
Since we've got the STS One book announced and we're looking towards using it in the autumn for certainly the first years in what we call the big problems course, we're going to talk about oceans there. But also across all of our community, we're going to ask people to think about this. So now's your chance. So tell them what you want them to think about. What kinds of questions might a reader consider while they're working through this book?
Well, I will connect it to my previous comments about connection and interdependence and interconnectivity. I think that theme comes through quite a lot. And the ocean is the medium through which we're thinking through these ideas, but also our relationship in the realm of nature, where we are in the web, and whether we think of ourselves as being within that web. There's a discussion about sharks being apex predators and how, and their role in that, and what happens if they're removed. But for some reason in the book, and even just thinking about how we tend to think of ourselves as humans, we tend to place ourselves outside of that. And in the book, we can see the impacts of that, how our lack of inserting ourselves within this natural network, what the implications are for the other species and creatures that live within it. And also our interdependence as humans to each other in terms of what we're eating, distribution of that, the distribution of hardships and resources, the implications of that as well. So I think this idea of interconnectedness or lack thereof is one that I became very interested in. And as I say, might have relationship to actor network theory, which is an STS modality.
But okay, so we've got a lot of ideas to think about it. New readers definitely put connectedness and where do humans fit here as part of your thinking as you're going forward. Okay, now let's step back and ask a slightly larger question, and let's talk about you and how this book connects to you.
Okay.
How does this book connect up with your own research?
Well, I became aware of the book while working on a project, an interdisciplinary project on oceans research, and I became very aware of how much still remains undiscovered about the ocean, and how much is unsettled about how we relate to each other when it comes to the ocean. I was surprised to find there's a lot of competitiveness when it comes to scientific research on the ocean, let alone, you know, this question of jurisdiction and who takes what from where. Even within the scientific realm, the fact that so much remains to be discovered means that there's almost a gold rush for learning more about the ocean, for generating knowledge around. And so the researchers on this project talked about this book quite a lot. And so I was interested in their takes on it. So a lot of legal scholars on this project and sociologists as well. And it was always interesting to hear from people who were ocean scientists or who were dedicated to understanding the ocean and how they felt about it. So I'm glad to introduce it to a primarily STS crowd who can then develop their own analyses of it. Generally, my interest is international collaborations on ocean-based scientific endeavor. So as I say, hearing about the different perspectives on the book and about ocean scientific endeavor more generally is how I came to this topic and to be interested in it. And I have to say, reading about the digital entrepreneurs and tech billionaires and why they're interested in lawlessness and offshore has reignited my interest in that group of actors and thinking about how the tech entrepreneur in different parts of the world, because I'm primarily interested in African tech entrepreneurs, yes, how they view these things. Do they also have this libertarian perspective? Mm-hmm. My sense is that they do not, but to deeper understand what drives them and their views of what entrepreneurship is, because there can be a particular take that we have that we've grown to think about. But in reading this book, I realized that there are actually many different perspectives of what a market is and how it should operate that still exist in 2024.
Brilliant. Folks, if you're listening, you're asking yourself, what is STS? This is STS. It's taking a fairly well, a clear story about outlaws on the ocean and then getting into fundamental questions of who's in charge, what is justice, where are we all going here, and ultimately, what do we want in the world that we create for ourselves? If you're thinking about what good is STS, there, that's what's good about STS. So Michelle, another STS concept that we're bouncing around an awful lot these days is the notion of a imaginary, mm-hmm. the idea of how do we imagine something to be as opposed to what it really is. Mm-hmm. So we know what the ocean really is. It's big and it's wet and it's cold and there's a lot of things going on in it. But we imagine the ocean to be really quite different. So how does that notion of a social cultural imaginary help us think about the oceans?
Well, I would say that this book is an ideal venue for thinking about imaginaries. As you say, we have a particular view of what the ocean is. We might also come up with ideas about tsunamis and that sort of thing. But with this book, we come away with a very different perspective of the kind of place that it is, that it holds a lot of humanity, that it's not the most comfortable place for humans to be in. However, they do create cultural and social connections and different ways of being and doing within it. And we also get the sense that there are some ways in which, despite its power and prominence, we are in a way almost holding it hostage and not allowing it to teem with the kind of biodiversity that we associate with, right? And so the book completely changes our imaginary of the ocean and allows for different perspectives on it to emerge and even different perspectives on ourselves. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a certain naivete that I had about human nature that is demolished by this book. And so this idea of imaginary or the vision that we hold of a particular place or object, how that shapes our relationship to it, what we think of it, what we expect from it. This book does the job of having us question that and therefore bringing the concept of imaginary into stark relief, we understand it better.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I think of ways to pull out the idea of imaginaries for everyday thinking is just sort of write down 5 or 10 words that come to mind when you think of a thing. Mm-hmm. So as you were saying, when most people think about an ocean, they think about the beach. Oh, the beach is sunny and warm and lovely for some people. So those would be the kind of ideas they would kick out. And that's one way to get to where the imaginary is, the fantasy dream vision,
right,
of what it is, as opposed to what a beach really is, which is there's a lot of flies there and they bite you and it's very hot and dry and it can be crowded and it can be noisy and all those things. And you think, well, that, you know, I don't want to think about that. I want my lovely beach holiday. Thank you very much. So the social cultural imaginary erases an awful lot.
I will emphasize that in STS, we're mostly interested in the socio-technical imaginary rather than the socio-cultural one. And in the Outlaw Ocean, it's very clear that relationship between the technical aspects, the technological aspects, and how they circumscribe our activities, shape what it is we do. And we are also shaped by the environments in which we are interacting. So that mutual shaping activity between the ocean, the people, and the technologies, that interaction is very important to think about.
Michelle, thanks very much. You've really opened the book up for us, and I look forward to working with you more over the year on the same topic. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Joe.
What a great way to get us started with the STS One Book program this year. And thanks, Michelle, for getting us started. Also, thanks, Michelle, for recommending the book. You know, picking just one book each year is really hard. It has to appeal across a huge range of academic interests. But I think Michelle's really brought in a winner. So, folks, get reading, join the project, and don't forget there's lots of related material online. If you know someone interested in the kinds of things we do here in STS, just ask them to get in touch. Maybe it's to explore journalism like this, or maybe it's oceans policy and governance, or sociology and the impact of new technologies, or maybe, just maybe, it's history of places like oceans and stories of people who live there. These all fit under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. We're a thriving community here at UCL, and there's always room for more. Music today included Rollin' at 5, and in the break you heard Ecossé in E-flat, both by Kevin MacLeod, and both are available online at filmmusic.io. We Are STS is the production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, just visit us online. Here's the address. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. We'll have another episode ready soon. More student projects are on their way too, I promise. Until then, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere. And together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address? ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.